And you are listening to Against the Grain on KPFA 94.1 FM and kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Is economics about profit, or should it be? Is economics about free trade or fair trade? And whose understanding of economics makes more sense, those of, say, anti-globalization activists or economics PhDs? And one more question, what if there is no one understanding of economics, or two or five or ten, that could encompass the diversity of how people today understand how the economy works and what kind of economics could make this world a better place? My guests today organized a conference earlier this month entitled Economics Representations, Both Academic and Everyday. Stephen Cullenberg is a professor of economics at the University of California, Riverside. His books include Globalization, Culture, and the Limits of the Market. And the paper he presented at the conference is entitled Representing the Global Economy, Economic Theory and the Anti-Globalization Movement. Steve joins us by phone from Riverside. Welcome to you.
Welcome, C.S.
David Ruscio teaches economics and policy studies at the University of Notre Dame. His most recent book is Postmodern Moments in Modern Economics, co-authored with Jack Amarillo, and he joins us now from his home in Indiana. Hi, David.
Actually, greetings from Chicago.
Oh, wow. Hello from Chicago.
And good to speak with you again.
Good to have you on. Stephen Cullenberg, in a nutshell, what was this conference about?
Well, the conference was about trying to look at the ways in which people outside of the economics profession, especially the mainstream of the profession, make sense and use concepts of economics, as many do. And here we're considering people from the world of art and culture to those in anthropology and literary studies within the academy, but also those who are kind of using economics in an everyday work in kind of policy debates and practical political work that people are using. And the presumption that we came to with this conference is that people are not simply adopting the ideas of the economics profession, or perhaps, as some economists might argue, using them incorrectly, but that they're actually coming up with their own theoretical approaches and ways of thinking about economics. And so we tried to bring together people from across the spectrum within the academy and a large number of people from outside of the academy who are doing policy and practical political work.
And Stephen, how did this topic interest you in the first place? You are firmly sequestered in the halls of academia there teaching economics. What interested you in economic discourses outside of economics departments and outside of the academy?
Well, I myself have always been interested in, I guess, what you could call heterodox economics of different types, political economy, philosophy and economics, postmodernism, some Marxian economics, and so on. And this was a way to kind of take a step back and think about how we all and many other people construct economic theories rather than just debating whether one theory is right or wrong. We want to actually look at how people are making sense of economics.
David Ruscio, how consistent or divergent are references to economics in today's world?
Oh, they're as divergent as one can imagine. I mean, part of the reasoning, as Stephen just explained, is that there's a kind of conceit, some would call it arrogance, even a kind of imperial or colonial posture on the part of at least some academic economists, that theirs is the only knowledge. And part of what led us to this conference is the recognition that there are multiple knowledges out there, not only in terms of their conclusions, but the way they're constructed. Many academic economists, international trade theorists like Bhagwati, macroeconomic theorists like Paul Krugman and others, argue that only certain kinds of knowledge and only certain knowledges that are constructed in a certain fashion, using certain mathematical techniques and so on, those are the only ones that are valid. As we look across the landscape, one of the things that we found is that outside the discipline of economics, but still in the academy, there are people in sociology and anthropology, literary criticism and cultural studies, political science, and in history who are doing a lot of economics And one of the things that's interesting is that they arrive at conclusions that are different from many academic economists, but they also go about their work differently. And the same is true outside the academy. If we look across the landscape in popular culture and amongst economic activists, people who work in NGOs and so on, the World Social Forum and the Community Farm Alliance in Kentucky and everything in between, people are doing economics that sometimes does and sometimes does not coincide with the conclusions of academic economists, but they're certainly going about their work differently. And so the first problem we faced was, how do we accord recognition to these different knowledges? How do we bring them into play? How do we construct another kind of conversation as an alternative to the one that exists now, which is basically a monologue?
To the extent, David, that the activists out there, the just ordinary citizens, and even the people in academia who are not economics PhDs, who work in fields, as you said, such as sociology, to the extent that they do not have formal economics training, what's the implication then about the value of that training if you are saying to me that economics as represented and understood by people without this training has value?
Well, I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think Stephen or I are in the position of saying, you know, all knowledges that are produced are equally valid. We're not populists in that sense. We don't want to celebrate all of these. I hear lots of economic ideas that I disagree with. The question is on what terms those disagreements take place. And I would argue the same thing for taking some economics courses. The last thing I want to do is argue that people should not learn what those discourses are. But that's precisely what the point is. To take economics courses is to learn how at least some economists think about the world and to learn what the basic assumptions of that are, better to understand them, and in all honesty, to criticize them.
There is a lot of talk, there was a lot of talk at the conference about mainstream economics, about neoclassical economics, the kind of economics that holds sway apparently both in academia and without, to a large degree. And you write about, in your presentation, David, you write about three fundamental principles upon which mainstream economics is based: preference, utility, and individual choice. I wondered if you could elaborate a little bit on each of those to give us an understanding of what the monolithic view seems to be. Although, of course, you're arguing that it's not, in fact, monolithic. There's a great diversity beyond that.
Well, there's a great diversity in the discipline itself. I mean, part of our project, part of our promoting this conversation is to give lie to the idea. When people say, this is what economists say, this is what economists think, Stephen and I both have PhDs in economics and teach economics, and we often don't recognize ourselves in those views. So when they say, this is what economists think, and I say, that's not what I think, and that's not what lots of my colleagues think, one of the things that we want to bring to this conversation is the fact that there are more economic theories, even in the discipline of economics, than neoclassical economics, right? But your question is about neoclassical economics, so let me talk about that. The kind of economics that we often confront in the most theoretical mainstream journals down to what we find in textbooks is constructed along the following lines. If we take people's preferences or desires as given, if we take human know-how, or what is sometimes called technology, as given, and if we take human abilities, or what is technically called human endowments, as given, then neoclassical economics proceeds to set up a framework whereby everything is reconciled in the market, and if each individual or each capitalist firm follows their own self-interest on the part of individuals if they maximize their utility or satisfaction, and on the part of firms if they maximize their profits, if they only are concerned about that, then ironically, neoclassical economists conclude they produce the greatest social good. Now, what's important about that is everything is reduced then to these three aspects of human nature, and those aspects of human nature are taken as given. So the idea that human beings have multiple capabilities, that they're formed within the cultures and economies and politics in which they live, all of that is discarded by neoclassical economics. It starts from the presumption that there's a universal human nature, and it consists of these three characteristics, and then arrives at those, for them, quite utopian conclusions. And that's precisely the reason that neoclassical economists celebrate free markets at the local level, at the national level, and at the international level. Does that make sense?
It sure does. To the extent that, let's say, somebody in academia would want to challenge that view, such as yourself, mm-hmm. how uphill of a battle is it to call into question some of these principles and to say, no, in fact, there are other values and other concepts that deserve priority in looking at economics?
Well, first stage is to see it as a representation, as Stephen was saying before. That particular approach often gets taught and often gets talked about as if it is a perfect representation of the real world. That is, that's what the, you know, that there are supply and demand curves out there in the real world, rather than being a metaphor, rather than being a construction. And as we know, all constructions, all metaphors, all representations have their biases. They're constructed in certain ways. They include some things, and they exclude other things. So when I teach neoclassical economics, which I do on a regular basis to 300 students at the University of Notre Dame, I teach it as a story about the world. It's a story that is a representation of the world, and importantly, it's a story in which people sometimes recognize themselves, sometimes do not, and whether or not they do has tremendous implications for how this world is organized. In other words, part of the inspiration behind the conference and the conversation we had there is to say that representations are not innocent. The way we look at the world, the way we imagine the world, has a tremendous impact on our individual behavior as well as on institutions in which we live.
To the extent, David, that you were trying to attract a discussion to UC Riverside, this was April 2nd and 3rd. Again, the conference was entitled Economics Representations, Both Academic and Everyday. To the extent that you were trying to attract ideas, or I should say maybe other stories about what's happening out there in the world in relation to money and trade and power, what were you looking for in particular? What new or alternative relations or institutions are you most interested in?
Well, in terms of organizing the conference, what I was interested in was bringing more voices and more stories to the table. Like Stephen, I happen to be a critic in large part of mainstream economics. So what interests me is to bring stories to the table that disrupt, that challenge the kind of false choices that we're often given with respect to the existing economy, and to encourage people to think about and to recognize that people are already thinking about alternative arrangements. Let me make that more concrete. When you listen to the debate right now, and it's going to go on between now and November amongst the presidential candidates and as it took place in the primaries, I would hear speakers refer to loss of jobs and national budgets as if there were, for example, only two choices. There was a kind of let free markets reign or adopt more protectionist standards with respect to the U.S. economy. On the one hand, I want to argue to the free traders that look at all the ways that there can be non-market relationships that already exist. Let's recognize them, and let's think about the ways in which they might have an important place in this world. As against the protectionists, I often want to argue that, well, that is important for one group of workers, for example, in the United States, but what about workers elsewhere in the country? Why are we saying that their conditions don't matter? So, as I look at it, there's a kind of false choice that often gets sold to people in large part because of the teachings of mainstream economics, and I want to say that there are other kinds of choices. There are other kinds of ways of both describing the world in which we live, describing the U.S. economy and the global economy, but also other ways in which we can begin to imagine. And part of the reason that I'm interested in things like popular culture and the way that economic knowledges are produced in popular culture, for example, in music and in novels and in poetry, is because they give evidence that people are voicing their frustrations and imagining alternative economic arrangements that are simply not recognizable in the teachings of mainstream economics.
David Ruscio, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Notre Dame. His most recent books include Postmodernism, Economics, and Knowledge, which he co-edited with Stephen Cullenberg and Jack Amarillo. Stephen Cullenberg also joins us by phone. He teaches economics at the University of California, Riverside. We're going to spend some time with Stephen going into his presentation at this conference called Economics Representations. Why, David, why does mainstream economics tend to ignore things like what's happening to low-wage workers?
Well, I mean, I think in part it is ignored. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that some mainstream economists ignore them because they package it all together in terms of a national economy. So, for example, one of the key theorems, one of the key arguments of mainstream economics is that nations as a whole benefit by specializing and engaging in free trade. Of course, one could then ask the question, what happens to different groups within those nations? Mm. Some mainstream economists, however, excuse me, my phone is... Hello.
Hi, we're
yeah,
with you.
Sorry, phone was on the fritz. Some mainstream economists, in fact, don't ignore the plight of low-wage workers. They care about them. I would argue a large number of them do. But then they tell a particular story about them. Part of the conceit of mainstream economics is that it constitutes a science and that nobody gets let into that conversation. Nobody has anything to say unless they engage in that science. One of the things that I think we've seen in recent years is that the discipline itself, especially the discipline that is dominated by mainstream neoclassical economics, is becoming more and more insular. And so economists, for example, unlike, well, given an example, anthropologists. Economists, unlike anthropologists, don't have to talk to anybody outside the academy. They can engage in a certain kind of theoretical work that involves mathematical models and finding the largest available data set and never have to talk to anybody in a trade union or never have to talk to anybody who's poor or never have to take into account those considerations. I think, however, I mean, to be fair, the best neoclassical economists do worry about it. In fact, some of them got into the business in order to find policies to alleviate conditions of poverty. Problem is, through their framework, they see poverty in a particular fashion, mostly as a result of the choices that individuals make. And it's that story that I think is problematic when it enters into public debate. Hmm. And by bringing other stories into the conversation, within economics, outside of economics, and outside the academy entirely, then we challenge that particular notion of science. Then we challenge that particular position within which only one group has something to say about those issues.
In your presentation in Riverside, you mentioned approaches like ethical economy, libidinal economy, economy of desire. Now, no doubt each is a complex concept, probably worth an entire semester of your teaching. But is there a way you could nutshell what these are generally about?
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things about terms such as ethical economy and libidinal economy, you could find them in the works of Lyotard and Foucault and Derrida and others. One of the interesting things is they're doing economics. They're talking about the economy. They're using economic concepts. These are all done by famous philosophers and social theorists outside the discipline of economics. And when I speak to my colleagues, Steve probably has the same experience, and I dare say that would be pretty universal. Our colleagues in economics have no idea what they're talking about. So we have here two economic languages. Not only do they have no idea, they actually think it's silly. They think it's wrong-headed. In fact, they would argue it's dangerous. I think that's an issue that you and Steve can talk about later on in terms of the globalization debate. So what are they all about? You're right. To put it in a nutshell is a bit unfair. But my sense is they're all searching for a way of thinking outside official economic discourse and thinking outside the market. In other words, all of them, to one degree or another, hearken to a place either lost in our past or in our very midst, where markets do not rule, where everything is not up for sale, where everything doesn't have a price. And so they're searching to articulate a place in the world as it exists and in a world that we could construct, to use the World Social Forum slogan, another world is possible, to search for that other world, to give voice to that other world, and to find a way conceptually, theoretically, to articulate what it might look like. I think that's what a lot of that is about. And that, of course, jars with much of mainstream economics, in which the market is the beginning and end of the story. Either markets exist, and all interventions into markets should be eliminated, or markets don't exist, in which case they should be created. So mainstream economics becomes a celebration of free markets, and much of this other literature is a search for a place outside of markets, beyond markets.
David Ruscio, economics professor at the University of Notre Dame. You are listening to Against the Grain on KPFA, KFCF, and kpfa.org worldwide. Co-producer Sasha Lilly is at the controls. My name is C.S. Song. We'll take a music break and be back with David Ruscio and Stephen Cullenberg.
If you reach back in your memory, a little bell might ring about a time that once existed when money wasn't king. If you stretch your imagination, I'll tell you all a tale about a time when everything wasn't up for sale. There was this cat named Johnny who loved to play and sing when money wasn't king. We'd all get so excited when John would give a show. We'd raise the cash between us and down the road we'd go. It spoke right to my soul. Every verse a diamond and every chorus gold. The sound was my salvation. It was only everything before money became king. Well, I ain't sure how it happened. Don't know exactly when, but everything got bigger and the rules began to bend. And the TV taught the people how to get their hair to shine and how sweet life can be if you keep it tight behind. And they raised the cost of living.
Jagdish Bhagwati, a mainstream economist well known for his work on trade theory at Columbia University, in his provocative paper in Foreign Affairs in 2002, states in the baldest of terms what many economists think is wrong with the anti-globalization movement. It is worth quoting at length, and I'll quote this at length. Globalization has fallen afoul of a younger group of critics, and the nostalgia of the fading generation cannot compete with the passions of these younger dissidents, who were so evident in the streets at recent world economic gatherings in Seattle, Washington, Prague, Quebec City, and Genoa, and who have made themselves heard on college campuses in movements such as the Anti-Sweatshop Coalition. Far too many of the young see capitalism as a system that cannot meaningfully address questions of social justice. Many of these youthful skeptics seem unaware that socialist planning in countries such as India, where he's from, which replaced market system-wide and quantitative allocations, worsened rather than improved unequal access. Such socialism produced queues that the well-connected and the well-endowed could jump, whereas markets allowed a larger number of people to access their targets. Capitalism is a system that paradoxically can destroy privilege and open up economic opportunity to many. But this fact is lost on most of the system's vocal critics. He goes on. Many of today's young, virulent anti-capitalists experience their social awakening on campuses in fields other than economics. English, comparative literature, and sociology are all fertile breeding grounds for such dissent. Deconstructionism, as espoused by the French philosopher Jacques Derrida, has, with its advocacy of an endless horizon of meanings, left the typical student of literature without anchor. Derrida's technique is to deconstruct every political ideology, including Marxism. Typically, however, it is capitalism that comes to the focus of these efforts, not Marxism. And this process often has nihilistic overtones, with the paradoxical result that many of its followers now turn to anarchy. Within sociology, this is still Bhagwati, new literary theory and old Marxist thought have equal influence on many students. These students have contempt for economic defenses of capitalism, asserting that economics is about value, whereas sociology is about values. Economists retort that as citizens they may choose ends, but as economists they choose the means for harnessing humanity's basest instincts through appropriate institutional design to produce public good. The presumption made by many of its radical students that sociology is a better guide to ethics than is economics is also misplaced. And now again, this was in Foreign Affairs, which is one of the premier journals of international relations, of course, in the United States. So that's the end of Bhagwati. But Bhagwati, by the way, continues with these kinds of attacks. Thus, according to Bhagwati, the anti-globalization critics are 1, badly educated, 2, ill-informed, and 3, misguided and counterproductive. They are badly educated because they study literary theory and sociology instead of neoclassical economics. They are ill-informed because they do not understand correctly, at least according to Bhagwati, the economic realities of actual socialist versus actual capitalist economies, with the subtext that they do not understand the real economic relations of globalization. Finally, they are misguided and counterproductive because the very policies and politics which they espouse will undermine their stated goals of poverty, alleviation, environmental improvement, human rights, and overall improvement of the standards of living for workers the world over. Now, rather than simply invoke the authority of neoclassical economics, I have begun to read the literature of the anti-globalization movement to see how they actually represent and theorize the economy.
The voice of Stephen Cullenberg speaking at a conference 9 days ago in Riverside entitled Economics Representations, Both Academic and Everyday. Stephen, an economics professor at UC Riverside and one of the organizers of the conference, is with us by phone. The show is Against the Grain on KPFA 94.1 FM. Steve, before I ask about what you found in your reading of the literature of the anti-globalization movement, let me ask you to expand on your reasons for quoting Jagdish Bhagwati at length, as we just heard on the tape.
Well, I think that that Jagdish Bhagwati, who is an eminent trade theorist, one of the most important economists in the profession, talking about these issues today of globalization, and he's talking to a broad audience, as you can tell from where he's publishing, really has the opinion that Alfred Marshall, actually a very famous economist back in 1884, expressed so clearly when he said that he wanted economists to be trained in theory which is, quote, inaccessible to laymen, unquote, so that they could enjoy a specialist voice in the art of policymaking. And I think Bhagwati captures this appeal to science that economics wants to be and have only certain voices be heard in the important arena of policymaking very, very well. And that's partly why I quoted him.
Now, to what extent is the economics, or have you found the economics used by, say, the anti-globalization movement, which you focused on in this paper? To what extent is that economics consistent with this mainstream economic science?
Well, surprisingly, actually, much of what I found by looking at a number of organizations, including Oxfam, the NGO, the FL-CIO, the Sierra Club, Scholars Against Sweatshop Labor, Public Citizens, Global Trade Watch, and many more, is that one of their basic approaches, not all of it, but one of the very strong approaches is that they're concerned with the question of distribution, with winners and losers. And I think David mentioned that one of the foundations of mainstream international trade theory is that countries will be made better off through specialization and trade. Now, that's a an important point that is kind of at the heart of the Ricardo or Heckscher-Ohlin way of thinking. But many economists recognize that there will also, at least initially, be winners and losers from trade. And they recognize that some countries like the United States, who have a comparative advantage in highly skilled and rich labor, will see situations with trade where actually the low-skilled workers and low-wage labor will actually lose out from international trade. And that's both recognized in theory and I think in terms of empirical work. But what economists do is they argue that the gains from the winners will be big enough to compensate the losers, so that at least in principle they are in a situation so that everybody is better off. And therefore, economists tend to wash their hands of a concern of these types of policy questions that Bhagwati was pointing to, and saying that that's up to politics to make those changes, but we as economists have shown that the country as a whole is made better off. Now, I think that the actual anti-globalization movement, the people who are living through these types of trade adjustments and so on, can appreciate the theoretical argument, at least in theory, but in reality, they ask the question, where are the trade adjustment policies? Where are the adjustments to and the compensation to communities and so on that are taking place? And in point of fact, the actual political economy of these communities and of the United States as a whole is nowhere to be seen when it comes to the compensation of these losses from distribution. So while many of these arguments are consistent with, at least up to a point, the standard trade theory, the empirical kinds of realities that people live on an everyday basis is ones that tend to get people to be critical of the policies of free trade that exist right now.
And then in your investigation, to what extent does the economics represented and understood by the participants of the anti-globalization movement that you looked at, to what extent are they inconsistent? To what extent do they present alternative economic theories to what mainstream economics seems to be doing?
Well, I think there are a number of things that they emphasize which are not really at the center of mainstream theory, but you find them across the board in terms of these alternative ways of thinking. And if I could just list a couple of them for you.
Sure.
One is that people tend to think about markets as being socially constructed. And much of this is consistent with institutionalist and evolutionary theory as opposed to kind of mainstream neoclassical theory. There's an attempt to denaturalize the market and recognize that markets are everywhere thick, meaning that there are specific institutions that constitute them which can differ over time and place.
Wait, what does denaturalize mean here?
It means that they're not just given without any question about their particular construction. They're not given from on high or from God, that they are actually something that human beings construct. And so that a labor market, for instance, might be a labor market which has at its heart decent minimum wages or living wages, or it may be a labor market that doesn't have that. And those are two different types of labor markets that are very different in their operation depending on whether there's the presence of living wages or minimum wages even, than whether they're not. And so we can discuss, without being opposed to markets per se, whether we should have certain types of labor rights and human rights and environmental protection that are all part of the process of competition, or whether those things should be taken out of competition and that people should be allowed to just compete over anything that they possibly want.
In other words, denaturalizing the economy means calling into question or evaluating each institution separately as to whether it makes sense or not for a better world.
That's exactly right.
I see.
I mean, one of the arguments that economists often make, which is a bit paradoxical, is they talk about free trade, and they want to allow us to be able to buy and sell everything. But then when we start to think about it, most economists, I think, would say certain things probably shouldn't be allowed to be bought and sold, like body parts or things that have to do with perhaps our bodies themselves in terms of prostitution and so on. And then you start to go down that road, you recognize that all markets are up for grabs in terms of how they're being constituted and how they're being regulated and whether they're being allowed to be purely free markets or whether there's a lot of circumspection in terms of how the markets are constituted. And from the anti-globalization perspective, there's a lot of politics and a lot of policy that's very important in terms of figuring out what the rules of the game of competition are. And that's something that I think is up for grabs that, frankly, most mainstream economists shouldn't think is objectionable, but tend to overlook when they criticize, as Bhagwati does, the approach that these anti-globalization movements are taking.
In what ways does the anti-globalization movement, and again, we're talking about a sampling of it that you investigated, in what ways do they view, say, the relationship between wage earners and capitalists, big capitalists, that differs, say, from mainstream economics?
A good question. I think that, again, this is not everybody, but most pay attention to what they would see as a fundamental trade-off between wages and profits, and see, in many cases, an intrinsic conflict between those who earn their income from wages and those who receive income as profit. Most in the mainstream would argue that there's a mutual advantage, and people earn based on their contribution to output, wages, and profit. And that's a fundamental difference. It really goes back to the old idea of exploitation that you can find in much of classical economics and in Marxian economics.
You also write about a certain attention to process that seems to be lacking in some of the neoclassical economics you understand. What does that mean?
Well, much of standard economics tends to look at initial situations and then adjustments to the new situation and compares the end of that process of adjustment to the initial situation. And I think that in terms of the anti-globalization perspective, people are concerned with that period of adjustment in a very deep and fundamental way. So, for instance, they're concerned with the presence or absence of adjustment costs to trade policies. They're very concerned about the loss of community that often takes place when you see whole areas that, you know, for instance, Michael Moore has been so successful in terms of showing in film, in terms of Flint, Michigan, and so on, when that kind of trade policy happens. They're concerned with the irreversibility of policy effects and kind of the path dependence of economic policy choices, so that once you go down a road of adjustment, all kinds of alternative and what economists might call externalities are involved in these choices, which tend to be, I think, frankly, undervalued by most economists, perhaps because they're difficult to value. But most people who live through these adjustments feel them and recognize them as being very serious.
Stephen Cullenberg is a professor of economics at the University of California, Riverside. His books include The Falling Rate of Profit, Recasting the Marxian Debate, and more recently, the book Transition and Development in India, which he co-authored. When we talk about these different aspects of what you found, notions of distribution and exploitation and process, do you feel, Stephen, that these aspects combine to form a coherent economic theory that's capable of challenging status quo economics in any serious way?
Well, I think they're certainly a coherent theory of thinking about economic policy and politics. I doubt, frankly, whether they're going to challenge the status quo of the economics profession as a kind of intellectual endeavor, in part because I don't think the people who are putting forward these ideas are concerned so much with the economics profession per se, but they're concerned with seeing political and policy results that they feel very strongly about.
Let me ask you about something in Bhagwati's article. You quoted it earlier. We played it, but let me just read it again. It says, many of these youthful skeptics, these are the anti-globalization dissidents, seem unaware that socialist planning in countries such as India, which replaced markets system-wide with quantitative allocations, worsened rather than improved unequal access. The implication there is that Bhagwati believes that the anti-globalization movement is full of a bunch of socialists thinking of, along very traditional lines in relation to setting up a socialist system. What is your sense of whether the anti-globalization movement is pushing for such a system?
I actually don't see any evidence of that. There may be a few, but certainly in the world, but the organizations that I mentioned certainly aren't pushing for any kind of central planning socialist model of the Soviet type or even of the former Indian type. That what you see is a whole array of kind of alternative forms and institutions of economic decision making, many of which could fall perhaps under the rubric of economic democracy or different forms of communal organizations. But they tend to be very decentralized in their focus. If anything, they're very consistent also with the role of markets in the economy, but just that the markets wouldn't be ones which are controlled by large corporations and by capitalist decision-making and so on. So it's a really different spectrum of alternative policies that people are putting forward. And Bhagwati's claim really is a red herring in terms of what people are saying in the anti-globalization movement.
What's your sense, Stephen, and I also want to ask David this, of the degree to which the left ought to be anti-capitalist? Is it fair to say that, look, capitalism is a system which produces inequities and economic and social injustice and therefore needs to be discarded? Or is there something within capitalism, within markets, that makes sense to you to hold on to in the context of perhaps developing alternatives to the system that we have today?
Well, when I think of capitalism, I think of both markets in terms of things that are sold and also the existence of wage labor. But also, most importantly, I think of the fact that in the enterprises that exist, whether large or small, capitalism is structured so that most of the people working there do not have any say over how the output or surplus is being distributed. And I think that that's a really important thing that needs to be changed. How much that changes actually the workings of the economy in terms of markets and whether we have wage labor in some sense is a secondary question. But, you know, when we go to work, we give up our citizen rights that we have in so many other places of our life. And we say that what we do at work is in control of the people who perhaps own the capital. But owning capital simply means that they have the right to buy and sell it. It doesn't mean that they have the right to decide where surplus goes or profit goes, whether it should be reinvested in the firm or used for environmental concerns or improvements in daycare or any other kind of community improvement. Those are things that the people who are involved in the working process, I think, should be seriously involved in. And right now, they're excluded from that. And I think that's the critical thing. And I think it's similar to what women initially argued for in terms of feminism, in terms of being excluded from decision-making, and people who were excluded from decision-making based on race and so on, and that this principle of exclusion is really something that needs to be addressed, much more importantly, in my mind, than whether we're going to sell things and buy things through markets, which, you know, frankly, are not always the worst way to go shopping.
David, what's your take on this?
It's much like Stevens. And part of the problem of capitalism is that it's a project, right? I mean, capitalism doesn't dominate the entire world. It's not the only thing that's out there. But it's a project, which is, as Stephen was talking about before, has its economic components and its political components and its cultural components, right? So it's a pretty complex endeavor in the world that is an attempt to kind of colonize the world, to make everything capitalist and to bring everything under the sway of markets. I agree with Stephen. There are all kinds of places where markets make sense, but once you start with the view that markets are socially constructed, as Stephen was saying before, then you can create different kinds of markets. You can also decide that markets need not exist here. But there's a kind of central problem of capitalism, and that is that a relatively small group gets to control the surplus and do with it what it wants. And that's a real problem. It's a real problem, as Steve says, inside enterprises, but it's also a problem in the world. Because that group that appropriates, the capitalists in traditional terminology, that appropriates that surplus then gets to decide which communities will thrive and which ones will not. Which cultural institutions, whether they want to give it to an opera or to a symphony or to a local cultural center and so on. So opening up this whole can of worms, arguing that capitalism is not natural, means that it can be constructed and reconstructed and replaced as we see fit, as we want to pay attention to human needs, as we want to pay attention to different kinds of community and so on. And that's exactly what goes against the grain of mainstream economics, in which capitalism and capitalist markets become a natural phenomenon, the only way of organizing the world, and the whole point is to make them expand across the world. That's where the battle is right now. It's a battle that takes place inside the discipline of economics, and it's the battle that takes place between economics and the rest of the world. What's interesting is that you spent a bit of time talking about Bhagwati. He is the first to complain that his views, those free trade views, are not being heard in the world. And that what neoclassical economists need to do is spend more time not just writing theoretical, mathematical articles and so on, but giving popular talks and speaking in the media and so on. So it's an interesting situation in which they are predominant in the discipline and predominant in some of the leading institutions in the world, in the IMF and the World Bank and the World Trade Organization. But when, for example, the Gallup poll goes out and says, you know, should minimum wages be increased, the vast majority of people in the United States say, yes, they should be, which runs exactly counter to the arguments of neoclassical economists. So there are lots of spaces out there.
Sure. Stephen Cullenberg, let me push you a little bit. Let's say we were able to get the control of the surplus of the profits of an enterprise into the hands of the workers rather than into the hands of big capital that can unilaterally decide what it wants to do with it. What would the role of the state be in that case? Do you have a vision of what that might constitute?
Well, I think the state would be, in some sense, much like it is today. And part of the reason I say that is because the types of changes I'm envisioning are ones that actually could be put in place today. And so it's not a grand, totalizing, in some sense, plan about a dramatic change in society, but it's one in which enterprises, big and small, slowly become converted to firms that are controlled more by the people who work there, or perhaps even some of the people in the community. And so the state would be a location of contestation, as it is today, it seems to me, where rules of the game of the bigger economy and the grander society, some of the things that are going across the country as a whole, would be debated. And perhaps those would change. I think they would, but certainly. But you know, the basic structure of economic decision-making in those enterprises and firms would be altered dramatically. Here's one example, I think, that certainly goes to the question of the anti-globalization movement. Much of capital today has the ability to move around the world, and the buzz phrase is outsource its labor, or can actually pick up its complete plant and equipment and move someplace else. It can make those decisions not based on the broad set of costs and concerns that all of the people who are involved in that company are dealing with, or perhaps that community, but really on narrow profit decisions, which the legal structure of the United States today allows them to do. There are many cases of companies in the Midwest where steel companies, which are profitable, have actually shut down and moved overseas or moved to the Southwest a number of years ago, and workers and communities left behind were devastated. I think that if we change the structure of decision-making within those firms, I think that that would change quite dramatically in terms of at least what gets brought to the table in terms of evaluating what are costs, what are benefits, and how should our decisions be made. Now, having said that, I'm not sure that all these other big changes in society would necessarily follow along, But I'm hopeful that there'd be a different way of thinking about things that would certainly change the terms of debate.
David Ruscio, we just have a couple minutes left. Give us a couple examples of ideas and analysis presented at this conference a couple weekends ago that you found especially striking.
A couple of examples. We met for a couple of days, and it was a pretty amazing discussion. It was a very, very rich discussion, so it's hard to summarize in a couple of phrases. But one of the interesting ideas that actually runs a bit counter to my friend and colleague out there in California is that people talked a lot about local models. And part of the local models that I think would, in fact, call for a quite different kind of state, not a state that's controlled by Wall Street or by multinational corporations, but one that responds to these local models and gives space to these local models. So both between academics and non-academics, people were searching for, how would I call it, a plurality of models. So you'd have one model in one place and a different model in another place. And part of the work that was done is to recognize that these models already exist, that people are already engaged in non-capitalist, non-market relationships in Appalachia and elsewhere in the United States, as well as around the world. And so part of the work we need to do is to recognize that they're already taking place, that there are spaces, in fact, large spaces of non-capitalism that already allow people to imagine a world beyond capitalism. And sometimes we get so fixed on capitalism being this huge monolith that we can't see anything else. So that's certainly one of the ideas that came out. Another one, to go back to our issue of representations and to back to the issue of social construction, is to say that if markets are not, as Adam Smith liked to put it, the natural expression, that people have a natural propensity to truck and barter, that's how Smith put it, and that is continued in neoclassical economics today, is to see the way that, for example, how-to manuals and advertising with respect to the stock market actually affect not only individual behavior, but how stock markets are formed. So the representations matter a great deal, not only for, quote, recognizing or misrecognizing the way the world is, but the way that people are attracted to these institutions through, as I say, advertising and how-to manuals, for example, in the financial sector, affect how the stock market itself is organized. Right?
I think we have to leave it right there, unfortunately. David Ruscio and Stephen Cullenberg teach economics at the University of Notre Dame and the University of California, Riverside, respectively. They co-organized a recent conference entitled Economics Representations. Thanks to both of you for joining me today.
Thank you.
And we will be preempted tomorrow and Wednesday by a special broadcast of the September 11th Commission hearings live from Washington, D.C., hosted by Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky. I'm C.S., suggesting that the important thing is not to stop questioning. And Sasha and I will look for you on Monday.
Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Sung and Sasha Lilly. Please visit our companion website, againstthegrain.org. And to make a comment or suggestion, drop us an email at againstthegrain@kpfa.org or call us at 510-848-6767, extension 209.